From Studio A in Podcast Village, Upper Georgetown, Washington, D.C., this is the best political talk show you've never heard of. It's Backroom Politics with your host and moderator, Justin Russell.
Hey, out there in radio land, it is time for the best political talk show you've never heard of. It is me, your host and moderator, Justin Russell, joining you from a remote and split-screen edition of Backroom Politics. I am here at my home studio down in Florida, almost Rush Limbaugh-esque type situation. Joining me from an undisclosed location in Northern Virginia, he is the former Undersecretary of Commerce for International Trade. He is the one that we know as the Honorable Alan Moore. Hello, Alan.
Hello, Justin.
And also joining us on the split screen, he is the former Joe Biden appointee, or I'm sorry, Joe Biden political operative. He is a lawyer in the great state of Maryland and the District of Columbia, the one that we know as Dan Lipner Esquire. Hello, Daniel. Daniel, we know he's there, but I bet he's trying to figure this out. Anyway, he's on. Also joining us from an undisclosed location in the Bay State of Massachusetts, he is the former Huffington Post contributing writer and author of several books, including Politics on the Rocks. He is the one that we know as Rich Rubino. Rich, how are you, sir?
Doing well, thank you.
Of course, keeping us honest behind the glass and in a very lonely studio. He is, oh, there's Dan Lipner. Dan Lipner, say hello to everybody because we already introduced you. And he's still staring at us. That's awesome. Behind the glass is Rob the Engineer. Rob, thanks for keeping us honest and keeping us remote. That is fantastic.
Absolutely.
Hey, let's start off by talking about what's going on in, first of all, I know everybody's asking the question about what is going on with the solar eclipse happening down in South America. We're keeping our eye on that. We're going to let you know when it actually, we are at full eclipse, because I know that's what's on everybody's mind. I know secondary to that, everybody's wondering about our kind of post-mortem on the Democratic debate that happened last week. 20 candidates on two stages, 10 and 10 apiece. It created for some drama, created for some technical issues, created a bunch of questions, and created possibly a new game set in the fight for the Democratic nomination for President of the United States, who will, in 2020, take on the incumbent president, Republican Donald J. Trump. Let's start first of all with the generalities. Dan Lipner, as kind of the resident Republican at large here.
Democrat.
Is the resident Democrat at large here. There was concern that the, you know, having all 20 split up on the stage was going to create a free-for-all, which it kind of did, but also kind of create a delicate situation that would create confusion and start taking out each other and start eating their own. Did that happen, do you think?
A little bit, but not as much as I had feared. The biggest problem with the large numbers of people on the stage were the questions that were whittled down to the hand raise to try and get people to segregate themselves out. And some of the very complicated questions that have even more complex answers don't lend themselves to a hand raise. Some of my colleagues here on this show raised some concerns for one of the particular hand raise moments that, of course, the Daily News, the Daily Caller and the New York Daily News both jumped on to say that this is to guarantee that Democrats will lose the election based on one of the hand raised moments, and that being the health care for people in the country illegally. But other than that, there were a few scrapes and squabbles that occurred, and that's what you'd expect from a primary. After all, everyone on that stage is hoping to become the next president of the United States. And in order to get there, you got to knock somebody else down, considering nobody was sitting at 50% of the vote. So the biggest noteworthy squabble that people walked away from was the Kamala Harris, Joe Biden fight, on his history of being able to work with folks across the aisle, some of which with some pretty horrendous records on racial issues. But in my personal take, if the Biden campaign can manage to spin it correctly, which they still haven't quite gotten there, Biden can still point out that that's what the American public is most desperate for right now, right. Finding a way right. to work together. Some of the other folks who did a lot did.
We'll get into that. Alan Moore, do you agree? Was this a positive or a negative for the Democrats as far as setting a baseline and challenging Donald Trump in 2020?
Well, it's a start. You know, I was not impressed particularly, but I wasn't expecting to be. There's a big sorting out process. There was very uneven treatment of the different of the 20 different people, which I'm still confused about. Some people got as much as 12 minutes of time, and others got as few as 3 minutes. I'm not saying they're all equal, but they're all up on the stage, and I felt that was just an ongoing, lingering concern. Having said that, that will soon disappear. Even the first night of debate kind of disappeared. Elizabeth Warren seemed to do reasonably well. Booker did fine, but you know, that was the news for one news cycle, and then along came Joe Biden and Kamala Harris. And that's a lot of what people talked about after the fact.
Alan, just jump in real quick. It almost seems like the Democrats who could have taken a piece out of the Republican, or at least learned a lesson and done a lessons learned off the Republicans last year when they had 17 and 20 on stage. Why do you think that the Democrats thought that this would be a good idea so early, so soon, and with so many?
I have no idea about the timing. You know, it's first of all, you got a whole bunch of candidates. You got 24 or so candidates in, and I think it's in the party's interest to start winnowing that down. The best way to winnow down is to put people on TV, and of course, you had to achieve certain fundraising numbers and poll numbers to even get a place on the stage. Right. There were four people who couldn't even make that, including one sitting governor. But there's I think the same 20 have another debate at the end of July. I don't know how they're going to divvy up the people. I guess they'll probably do another random draw. I think that there's better ways than randomness here, because the second night was loaded with a larger group of kind of credible candidates, at least at this early going. And then come the fall, there will be a whole new standard of what you have to do to get onto the stage, and you'll have to have money from a lot more people, more money. And you have to show up better in some of these national polls.
Right.
And it's not hard to figure out where about so far close to half of these people will go, which is off the stage.
Right.
So I don't have a, you know, I think it's just they just kind of want to get moving here instead of have it float around. And I think the candidates are interested and the party is interested in winnowing right. this thing down.
Right. Rich Rubino, do you agree? I mean, was this a good thing? Because to me, it almost seems like they were playing, you know, preseason baseball, you know, you know, it was spring training baseball games in Miami. How does this help the Democratic Party beat Donald Trump?
I don't know if it helps them beat Donald Trump, but I think it helps them in terms of winnowing out and winnowing in. You know, when Fred Harris was running for president in 1976, he came in fifth place in Iowa. He wasn't supposed to do very well, so he said it winnowed me in, meaning he became a major candidate. And I think particularly Secretary Castro, who was really an afterthought, you know, this is somebody who had given the address at the Democratic National Convention, had since been forgotten. He had a very strong showing. The next day he got a lot of fundraising. He's now, I think, winnowed himself in.
Now, in terms of the other candidates, I think this helped in many respects because some of these candidates have other offices that they can run for. Now, if John Hinkelooper, the governor of Colorado, or Beto O'Rourke, their former congressman from Texas, had done a superlative job, people would have perhaps viewed them as top tier or even second tier candidates, but they didn't. So now there's pressure saying, in John Hinkelooper's case, there's an open Senate seat in Colorado. There's a Senate seat, Cory Gardner's seat in Colorado. The pressure will be on him to run for that instead of running for president. In Beto O'Rourke's case, because he did poorly and because he didn't seem well prepared, there's speculation now, well, John Cornyn's up for re-election, run for that instead. Tulsi Gabbard, she has re-election woes at home, and Eric Swalwell could run for re-election as well in California, since, you know, even though he kept saying it's time to pass the torch, no one seemed to, you know, they didn't understand that Bernie Sanders, for example, his main supporters were people 18 to 24-year-olds. They don't care how old you are. They just care whether you have a message that resonates with them. And the fact that Seth Moulton did not get into the debate, there's a possibility that former Democratic Congressman John Tierney, who actually unseated in 2014, may be coming back and running against them. So these candidates, I think, might be leaving the race before Iowa just because of their own political interests. But I think the real winner was Secretary Castro, certainly Kamala Harris, who I think did not get nearly enough attention. I think particularly in the African-American community, you look at where Joe Biden was versus her, and it was just it's just amazing how far Joe Biden was ahead. It reminded me of Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton. Once Barack Obama won Iowa in 2006, in 2008, you could saw the numbers turn around. Hillary had been ahead of her with African-Americans. As soon as they saw that an African-American could win in a white community, all of a sudden Barack Obama moved ahead. So Joe Biden, you know, he was certainly the loser, but it was also – it's only the first debate, and he just picked up support from the governor of Connecticut today, Ned Lamont. He's certainly not dormant. Right. It's just that he's going to lose a little bit of momentum, and that juggernaut and that aura of inevitability is going to attenuate a little bit.
And we're going to get into some of those details here, but let's kick off in depth on this with the subject that you brought up, Rich. Dan Lipner, you know, Rich was talking about the primary subject that everybody was talking about, and that was the interaction between Kamala Harris, the junior senator from California, former attorney general, former prosecutor, and former vice president and U.S. Senator Joe Biden. The interaction was tense. I think it was, I wouldn't say confrontational, but it definitely had an abrasive nature to it. Was that fair for Kamala Harris to make the move against Joe Biden on race at that point? Was it calculated, and was it a good move? You're on mute, Dan. It gets better and better. Dan.
So, yes, now I'm off mute. Sorry about that. Just making sure that since I am smoking a cigar and having my scotch here, I wouldn't say it's unfair, but I also find issue with that characterization, especially considering some of the numbers as far as who moved where in a natural tightening that would occur anyway. Both Kamala Harris and former Vice President and former Senator Joe Biden were both talking about their own political realities of the time. The Harris talking her own political reality and as well as her own just reality and her own history as a child growing up in California and in a segregated school district that was desegregated with busing. That changed her life and changed her life dramatically. And I don't slight her in the least, and I don't think anyone in the Democratic Party would slight her for talking about her reality and how that changed the course of her life and how let me cover this here.
Okay.
The Joe Biden, and this is where he kind of flubbed ever so slightly, which thankfully, at least to my perspective, hasn't grown more, but it still could, was talking about his reality, which was working in a Senate that still had vocal and out there and strong segregationists in it. And he had made the choice to govern with those segregationists, while not necessarily on those issues particularly. He did choose to work with them on other governing issues. He could have found a better way to state it, but both of which were talking about their political realities. And as the numbers have drawn out from most polling, though the CNN poll has the most dramatic move from Joe Biden, both of them seem to survive it. And Harris, more than this, the racial issue, just as how she carried herself on the stage, raised herself into the top tier of
candidates. But let me get into the subject matter at hand on this one, Dan, is because one of the things that came up was when they were talking about Senator Harris's experience there in Berkeley, California, how she was one of she was part of that busing situation out there. When she brought that up, a lot of people criticized Vice President Biden when he brought up the fact, and he made the comment very, very directly, saying that was a choice by the Berkeley, the city of Berkeley school district. That was not a U.S. issue. Was he right in that? And why is he taking so much heat for that answer?
I mean, it's the heat of the issue has to go with the history of busing in this country and whether or not, depending on your perspective, you consider it a success. And unfortunately, with the, as we've all mentioned, the numerous number of candidates on the stage, if you really wanted to go into the history of busing and where it succeeded, and I would argue where it failed, that it was a policy that, absent any other choices, was a way of approaching things. And as Kamala Harris correctly pointed out, the reason for the United States, the federal government, to get involved is because of many states fought it and fought it tooth and nail, which was not the case for her in Berkeley, California. However, again, this is the getting lost in the weeds and where the large number of candidates creates an issue. Lots of places have discovered that you needed a carrot and stick approach, and the carrot was much more effective than the stick.
Right.
In my case, in South Florida, magnet schools popped up in a large number of areas, and school choice popped up in a large number of areas in other places around the country in order to find a more democratic way of having desegregation by actually having people choose to go to different schools and magically having those choices steered with demographic information to make sure that those suddenly become significantly more diverse
schools.
But in this debate with that number of people on the stage, that's a really complicated idea to get across.
Alan Moore, do you agree? I mean, was Joe Biden right? Was Joe Biden wrong? And should he take the heat for that answer?
Well, he deserves to take all the heat that anybody can put on him. For somebody who had already gotten into a bit of trouble in the recent past, talking about numerous times how he had worked across the aisle, not across his own aisle, across the divide of the Democratic Party at that time, with a couple of Southern arch segregationists, that he would make the point. He disagreed with them on many, many things, but he also found it possible to work with them. Unfortunately for him, one of the issues and the main issue here that's being talked about that he worked with them on was to get them to join his effort to slow down or stop federal required busing. So it was right down their sweet spot, if you will. You would like to have thought that if he's going to talk about working with those guys, it would have been on foreign policy on some other domestic issue that didn't have race associated with it. But that's a choice that he made, and he's having to live with it. And he's not doing a very good job of explaining it, even though I think polls to this day show that more than 70% of Americans oppose the idea of court-ordered or forced busing of kids. And he was responding back in the day to the dynamic in Delaware and the dynamic that existed in Boston, in Kansas City, and a whole host of places across the country where courts were coming in and ordering busing. Now, it doesn't really, for me, it doesn't make that much difference if it's a local decision or something imposed. There's always some pressure involved.
Alan, there's an insinuation. I mean, it almost seems like, and I don't want to put this out there, but I've heard other people talk about this, it's almost like they are involuntarily race baiting each other almost.
Well, I mean, what Biden was trying to do was pat himself on the back for being able to work with people with whom he had significant differences. Unfortunately,
at the same time, Kamala Harris is saying you don't understand being black, which, I mean, she's right. But to throw that out there, does that help the Democratic cause?
Well, whether it helps the Democratic cause or not is a very interesting and important question here. But all I'm saying is Biden made this choice. And then she and Cory Booker, and I think and some others, especially after the first comment where Sanders and Warren were also piling on Biden, saying, you got to clean this up. He chose to go there. And what Kamala Harris did, and I don't have a complaint with her for doing this, she clearly made a calculated play. She was waiting. She injected herself. If you'll remember, she said, I'm the only black person on this stage, and I have some comments to make. And then she proceeded to do this little piece about this little girl, and that little girl was me. The next day, they're selling T-shirts with that phrase and her picture. You don't do that. You know, spontaneity. I don't have a quarrel, okay, with somebody plotting and planning and doing it, but she's somebody to be reckoned with, but she was setting the trap. Biden kind of had already walked up to it, and she rolled with it. The potential problem for the Democrats here, I think, is that they're now sort of saying, well, Joe opposed busing with the help of these arch segregationists, and Kamala Harris is here because she was a beneficiary of busing. How does the party feel and how does the country feel about this busing issue, which has been largely kind of put aside? And is that an issue that they want to raise up and be a major issue in this campaign?
Right.
Alan is right on this. There is no favor done to the Democratic Party relitigating busing, especially considering it is not a contemporary issue in this country. Relitigating this is not going to do anyone any favors.
But here's a question, Rich Rubino, for you is when you look at this issue, and again, going off of what Alan and Dan were saying, this is an issue that was settled almost two decades ago. And they bring it back now. Are the Democrats involuntarily injecting race where, quite frankly, it doesn't need to be injected?
Yes, but it's also, I think that was the trencher analysis, but I also think that part of it was, you know, Joe Biden's faux pas. When he spoke of all the senators, and he's done this many times before, by the way, remember, he spoke at Strom Thurmond, the guy who ran in 1948 as the Dixiecrat presidential candidate. He spoke at his funeral. He had a great relationship, for example, with Jesse Helms, who basically got elected for the United States Senate in part because he was also a segregationist from North Carolina. They had a great relationship. He had complimented him in the past. In terms of his dealing specifically with Senator Eastland, you know, I think the optimal response we could have said was when he brought up and he said, you know, when Senator Harris said, you know, why were you dealing with these segregationists? He should have said, well, you know what? The first time I met Senator Eastland, he asked, what brought you to the United States Senate? Why did you want to win? Biden looked at him and said, civil rights. You know, that's something I've heard him say in the past. That would have been a great response to that. Now, I mean, in terms of bringing up an issue, I guess it shows I guess you could say the same thing, for example, you know, when Bob Dole ran in 1996, I guess you could have brought up his position on the Vietnam War because he had been in for that long. In Joe Biden's case, I mean, this is a guy who got elected the same day Richard Nixon was reelected in 1972. And obviously the issues have changed since then. But, you know, when you have somebody who's the front runner and, you know, you have to go after him for something. And in this case, I mean, there's a litany of folks you can go after. You can go after him for the crime bill. You can go after him for the drug war, for the deregulation of the credit card industry, for the Iraq war. Certainly Bernie Sanders tried that. But, you know, I don't think he really expected that particularly the busing issue would be what people would go after him for. But I will say this for Joe Biden. He would have done a lot better when he talked about people that he's worked with. If he talked about Dick Lugar, for example, who he's worked with on the Foreign Relations Committee. If he talked about how he worked with Orrin Hatch, how he worked with John McCain, for example. There were a lot of Republicans that he had worked with. Why he chose those specifically, those specific senators, I think part of that, you know, was just off the cuff. But he's done that in the past. And it's never really become a huge issue for him. You know, Bill Clinton, for example, here's just another example. Bill Clinton just went out of his way. His political mentor was J. William Fulbright. Now, J. William Fulbright was a segregationist who signed the Southern Manifesto. The reason Bill Clinton liked him was not because he was a segregationist. He disagreed with them, and they used to argue about it. They used to argue with each other about it when Bill Clinton was an aide, but because he was opposed to the Vietnam War. So he supported Senator Fulbright, and he remembered him for that respect. Why is there a Russell office building in the United States Senate? Not because Dick Russell, the longtime senator, who was also an arch segregationist and ran for president in 52 on a segregationist platform, but because of what he'd done for the rules of the Senate, what he did for agriculture, what he did for defense. And I think that what Joe Biden was thinking, you know, that segregation was just part of that. But in terms, certainly if you're an African-American, the one thing you're thinking of is the fact that person is an African-American. I'll just say one more thing in terms of, remember back in 2002, Trent Lott, then the Senate Majority Leader, had come out and said that, you know, that if Strom Thurmond had been, this was at Strom Thurmond's 100th birthday, and Strom Thurmond's segregationist, he said if Senator Thurmond had been elected president in 1948, we wouldn't have had all those problems over all those years. And, of course, Strom Thurmond's main platform that year was civil rights, but Trent Lott then said, well, no, I was talking about his support for, you know, his support for being anti-communist, his economic policies. But the one thing that's going to be indelibly marked in terms of Strom Thurmond is segregation. And that's certainly true with Senator Eastland. And when you think of Herman Talmadge, you know, the one thing you're going to think of him for throughout history is going to be segregation.
So I got to cut.
Dan Lipner. So, all right, hold on. Dan Lipner, we got 2 more minutes left in the segment. We're going to be talking about this in the next segment as well, but go ahead real quick.
So when Joe Biden was chairman of the Judiciary Committee and ran into some trouble and actually talked about stepping down, his relationship with Strom Thurmond was one of those items that came up. And all the way to when Joe Biden eventually eulogized Strom Thurmond.
Yes.
And one of the lines that Joe Biden said when talking about Strom Thurmond, when he talked about stepping down, Strom Thurmond, and forgive me for the horrible accent I'm about to do, said, "Joe, you're my chairman. I'm not gonna support you stepping down. I think you should be there. And if you need me to come campaign for you in Delaware, either campaign for you or get you, whatever is going to do best for your campaign."
That is absolutely the worst. That is absolutely the worst impression of the senator I've ever heard in my life.
That might be the worst. That may be the worst impression of a senator.
Play that out.
Is exactly what he said.
Yeah, and apparently it's open mic night here at Backroom Politics.
That matters. Those relationships matter, and how politics matters.
Yep.
And there are other things beyond those issues that can actually claim the day and for the rest of the American people.
Dan, hold that thought.
Yep.
Dan, hold that thought. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to continue talking about this because we got 18 other potential nominees we got to talk about. This is Backroom Politics in a split-screen edition. We will be back here in about 2 minutes. Stay with us. Without any reason or a word to say, that man turned his keys in, he packed and went away. What good is living? I'll soon be giving my body up to the ocean. That's the way I feel today.
love him, how much I love him. I get a desperate notion, that's the way I feel today. My heart is aching because he's making a plaything of my devotion. That's the way I feel today. Without any reason or a word to say, that man turned his keys in, he packed and went away. What good is living? I'll soon be giving my body up to the ocean. That's the way I feel today. I said, that's the way I feel today.
From Studio A in Podcast Village, Upper Georgetown, Washington, D.C., this is the best political talk show you've never heard of. It's Backroom Politics with your host and moderator, Justin Russell.
Hey, we're back with the best political talk show you've never heard of, special edition. Joining me on the quad chart, Alan Moore in Virginia, Dan Lipner in Maryland, Rich Rubino in Massachusetts, and of course, behind the glass in Studio A, in a very lonely Studio A, Rob the engineer. Hey, we're continuing our postmortem on the Democratic debate that happened last week. A lot of attention put on the differences between Vice President Joe Biden and Senator Kamala Harris of California. But let's look at some of the other key players in this.
Hey, Justin, before you turn, can I just make two more quick comments on?
Yeah, real
on,
quickly,
on Biden
real quickly, because
Harris.
I want to move on the other 18.
Yeah, so. Right. So Biden seemed unready for this attack, which is surprising because it had come up. But when he tried to give a response, and he was given 30 seconds to respond because she had invoked his name and then kind of went on, he was trying to get there with an explanation. And then the red light went on and he said, oh, my time's up. Well, he's the only person up there for 2 days who seemed to pay any respect to when the time was up, and it looked awkward, and it ended his comment prematurely, and that was an unforced error on his part, and he's going to have to work on that to not give up those opportunities again. The other thing I wanted to just say about Harris, we've known that she has this ability to pull a stiletto out and stick it in, but she can't always back it up. And I'm thinking about in the case of during the Kavanaugh hearing, when she said to Kavanaugh, now, have you ever had a conversation with a member of a particular law firm? You need to think very carefully before you answer. This is really important. And Kavanaugh was like, gosh, I don't even know who's at that firm and so on. And everybody thought she had something. And it was nothing. There was never any follow-up. So, she was ready. She was prepared. She stuck it into Biden, and it worked for her. It didn't work in the case of Kavanaugh, but it gave us a little bit of insight into the kind of prosecutorial tactics that she might have learned as a prosecutor, and she'll be back with more, I suspect.
Right. You're probably right. Let's look at the other 18 that were out there. One of the things I noticed quite frankly was the bad showing of several of
Beto.
Those on stage.
Beto.
Well, I was going to get to that, Dan Lipner, but let me go to Rich Rubino first. I want to throw out a couple of names out there, and I'm going to ask Rich Rubino, do you think they should even be worth discussing? Congressman Eric Swalwell, yes or no?
Yes, he should be worth discussing because his tactic of trying to pass the torch, I think, failed miserably. And I think that I think what he proved is that people don't care about age. They care about what your ideas are, just like, why is Donald Trump so popular in Alabama and Mississippi? Not because he has a Confederate flag and speaks in a Southern accent. It's because they agree with him on issues, even though he's from, New York City.
John Hickenlooper.
Probably just simply because the question is, will he now run for the Senate in Colorado? That's really the question with him.
Okay. Dan Lipner, let's talk about Beto. Beto had a marginal showing in the polling leading up to the Miami debates, and it appears that he has taken a hit. It almost seems like it wasn't that he was unprepared. It was that he didn't read in or he just got caught in the deer in the headlights look about him. It just didn't seem to be his best showing. Were we just setting too high expectations for Beto?
I think it's too high expectations. And on top of that, also note who took Beto down in the debate. It was a fellow Texan, Julian Castro. And
right.
That matters. And I have a sneaking suspicion there might be a more personal issue at play between the two of them. Yep. Beto actually, yes, I agree with all of that. And while it's not my personal critique against Beto, I have heard several of my Democratic friends, some of which has to have some significant political juice, say, quote, the broiness of Beto O'Rourke isn't appealing to them. And his inability to deal with Julian Castro, who I actually have been actively against, but I will absolutely give Castro the credit he deserves for smacking Beto for not knowing the details of an issue he was talking about, that Beto seemed completely unaware that running for president of the United States, even in the primary, is very different from running against the most hated person in the U.S. Senate. That's a very different criteria. And especially in a Democratic primary, Castro has something to gain, and Castro presumably wants to be still have juice in Texas. So he's seeing his political future on the horizon as well.
So let me ask you this question, Dan.
If he knocked down Beto in the process, that's a win for him.
Dan, let me ask you this question then. From a Democratic perspective, was Beto O'Rourke's performance against Ted Cruz in the 2018 senatorial race, in the 2016 senatorial race, was that a fluke? Or has Beto O'Rourke lost his, cool hipster surfer dude allure?
No, he can still be the broiness is the co-hip, the hipster surfer dude, and the hipster dude who apparently speaks Spanish better than Julian Castro, which is probably part of the reason for the takedown and the way it occurred, because Castro showed he knows more about policy that affects Latinos more than Beto O'Rourke does. But that takedown was a real thing. And Beto, I'm not saying it's a fluke. That said, running against Ted Cruz is not running against Kamala Harris.
Right.
The most hated person in the U.S. Senate, and who has put himself front stage nationally and is hated by numerous people beyond just Republicans at a national level. Yeah, so Ted Cruz was a great target, and everyone was dreaming of knocking out Ted Cruz. I would be surprised, and I don't think I've ever seen the story, but I would not be surprised if there were lots of Republicans that donated to Beto O'Rourke's Senate race to try and get rid of Ted Cruz.
Alan Moore, the one person we haven't talked about yet that we need to is Senator Warren, the Democrat.
Marianne Williamson. That's just the key.
No, we'll talk about the head of the Love Coalition here in a second. But Ellen Moore, we have not talked about Senator Warren. Elizabeth Warren, a lot of people saying that not only did she hold her own, she actually might have done something that a lot of people didn't think were possible. She actually might have become somewhat relatable. Do you agree?
Well, I think she's been increasingly relatable from people that a few people that I know well who didn't take to her initially, kind of bought into the warmed over Hillary narrative, which is demeaning and just kind of intellectually lazy, but began paying attention to what she had to say and realized that she was very smart and very quick and not nasty in unrelatable as some people found Hillary Clinton to be. So you know, she's not all warm and fuzzy, but she doesn't try to be somebody who she's not. She's trying to have a lot of different policy proposals, and of course, she claims that her
so-called wealth tax, where she wants to simply take small.
Do we lose
from wealthy people? I don't know if we lost anybody.
Keep going. We're good.
Okay. And so she had a good night, but she didn't have a lot of competition either. I think now everybody wants to see what Warren and Kamala Harris will do to each other.
I think we're losing the good secretary there. Alan Moore, why don't you go ahead and call back in here in a second. Rich Rubino, talking about Elizabeth Warren, when I've heard from people in Massachusetts that they love her as the senator from Massachusetts, but they can't be sure that they can get on board with her as president. Is there any truth to that?
It's truth among Democrats specifically. If you look at polls, at least this is prior to the debate, Joe Biden was actually ahead of Elizabeth Warren in Massachusetts, yes.
Why can't she win her own state with her own party? Expectation is she can win the nomination and beat Trump.
Because going back to her first race when she ran against Scott Brown in 2012, there has been a certain negative buzz about her, and it's very hard for her to get votes beyond the Democratic base. You know, there's a Democratic base that absolutely loves her, but in terms of, first of all, she consolidates a lot of support against her. When she ran for Senate in 2012, the whole idea, for example, that she had said that she was a Native American, that galvanized a lot of people. Howie Carr, who was a big talk show host here, really made a huge issue out of that. Donald Trump, when he came up here in 2016 during the primary, he made a huge issue out of Elizabeth Warren. She's a very polarizing figure. Now, the people in the Democrat, a lot of the folks in the Democratic Party know that. They know how much Republicans specifically are able to fundraise off of her, first of all. Secondly, there's the fact that even though she comes from Oklahoma and has three brothers in the military, the fact that she works in Harvard and lives in Cambridge, specifically Democrats around here know that this reputation that Massachusetts gets, that every Democrat is essentially a Cambridge Democrat. And a Cambridge Democrat, Cambridge is, just like San Francisco, is considered probably one of the most liberal parts of the country, and they're considered out of touch with mainstream America. I think there's a belief that once Donald Trump starts saying, she's a Cambridge liberal, that's going to show that around the rest of the country, people are going to be very trepidatious about that, and it'll be very hard for her to relate to that person in Columbus, Ohio, to that machinist in Columbus, Ohio, because of that image. Now, it's true that the Democrats like her, but it's also true that there are a lot of independents and a lot of Republicans specifically who will say, you know what, I don't think she's electable. I don't think she can get elected. And part of that, by the way, is the fact that I think a lot of it goes back to some overhang from Michael Dukakis. When Michael Dukakis ran in 1988, he was from Massachusetts as well. And George H.W. Bush, even though they both had a patrician pedigree, he said, his foreign policy comes from the Harvard boutique. And just there was the whole idea of this being this Massachusetts liberal. And I think John Kerry suffered the same thing in 2004. It's kind of the never again effect. People are saying, we know what can happen when somebody from Massachusetts is nominated. But you can say the same thing, by the way, from Senator Harris, because, when you talk about Oakland and San Francisco, I mean, what's worse than Cambridge? Perhaps it's being from Oakland and San Francisco. So Trump can certainly use that against both candidates, whereas he wouldn't be able to use that against, say, Joe Biden from Delaware, and certainly not someone from Tim Ryan from Ohio, for example.
Rich Rubino, I just got to tell you something. I can see Dan Lipner here in the camera, and he about choked on a cigar when you were going through your statement there. Dan Lipner, you want to rebut that?
So there are a couple of things at play there. Let's start with Kamala Harris. And then I'll backtrack to Elizabeth Warren. So Kamala Harris did a bunch of things there, and she did a very good job. However, my biggest fear with Kamala Harris is making her bones and knocking down Biden on a racial issue. And now I'm going to contrast Kamala Harris with a Barack Obama. Barack Obama went out of his way in 2007, 2008, when running for the primary, to make sure that any of his rhetoric did not make him the black candidate. And I know this is a little iffy of a statement. However, going back to Barack Obama's 2004 convention speech, where he said, there is no red America, there is no white America, there's no black America, there's no white America, there's the United States of America. That was a very poignant moment and something that he not only ran with for his presidential race, but he really made it a point to not get boxed in specifically on race, in spite of the fact that he was an African-American and an African-American member of the Senate who dealt with all the racial issues that were America. But he went out of his way to make sure that he was not strictly seen as the Black candidate. That was to his credit for how Barack Obama framed his race. And it is a problem for how Kamala Harris is framing her race. Now, it's possible that it's just going to be a small segment of her campaign. I really hope it is, because I'm not certain the rest of America is ready for somebody simply to run on the racial issue, especially if they are the underrepresented party.
Right.
Now, as far as Elizabeth Warren goes, I am also a huge Elizabeth Warren fan. And as far as Elizabeth Warren goes, my fear isn't her herself. My fear about Elizabeth Warren is the baggage she brings, and I'm not talking the baggage she brings as a candidate, I'm talking the baggage she brings with her consulting team. I am a veteran of the Kerry campaign in 2004, and the scariest words that I ever heard were constantly the phrase, "Well, I'm from Massachusetts, and me and John spoke about these issues way back when. Oh, my God. This is particularly an issue when you talk about politics and the idea that Massachusetts is any part of the rest of the country as a microcosm. That's a scary thing. Elizabeth Warren herself has been amazing. She's been one of the only Democrats who can go out as a surrogate in red America, talking about economic issues and talking about how the issues that hurt working class Americans in all parts of the country, regardless of race,
is
pretty consistent. That said, I'm afraid that those consulting folks will misconstrue how to frame her at a national level and instead frame her at a liberal East Coast or West Coast, ignoring the central parts of the country.
Right. Alan Moore, the other one we haven't talked about, Bernie Sanders. Did Bernie burn out?
So Bernie kind of disappeared, other than being the same Bernie that we saw 4 years ago and the same Bernie we used to chuckle at on Saturday Night Live.
Right.
The yelling, semi-wild, the gesticulating guy who wants to give a lot of free stuff to everybody, and you know he's the guy that basically held his hand up. I was in agreement earlier when Dan said hand raised questions are never a very good thing for a large group of politicians, but you know whose health plan would get rid of private insurance, and his hand shot right up, and that's one issue that divides them. But that's just a really challenging, difficult position, I think, for Democrats to be in.
Let me ask you
down
Alan,
the road.
Alan, let me ask you this question. Hold on, Dan. Hold on. I'll get to you in a second. But Alan, let me ask this question. It almost seems to me that Bernie, for the large part, is playing the exact same cards he played in 2016. And it almost seems like American voters are saying, hey, been there, done that, got the T-shirt. That the liberal mayor from Vermont, old Jewish guy from Brooklyn thing isn't working as well as they may have thought. Is that accurate?
Well, I don't know that. He's got a loyal following among young people, and some of whom voted the last time. Some of whom were younger and coming up. There's a slice of the party that likes how he talks, likes his ideas, and wants to reward him for bringing into the mainstream of the party some fairly aggressive redistributional ideas. Having said that, I think most people would be more comfortable if it wasn't a 78-year-old who was talking about it, but maybe somebody in his 30s or his or her 30s or 40s or 50s.
Right.
Or in the case of Elizabeth Warren, she's only about to be 70, I think.
Right. Dan Lipner is cringing right now. If you could see him, Alan, go ahead, Dan Lipner.
Again, I'm not a Bernie for president supporter. I'm glad that Bernie's out there and has a seat where his ideas can have a forum. However, Alan's take is somewhat incorrect. Bernie's losing not because his ideas are losing, but his ideas have better vessels to push their way forward. As far as the international relations or foreign relations goes, Tulsi Gabbard, who is a Army reservist who actively served in the military, has taken the mantle of getting us out of these wars. And so some of Bernie's points disappear there. Elizabeth Warren talking about where working class folks are losing constantly in this booming economy, Bernie's losing there. And as far as folks who entirely have a different take on politics and how to get things done, my God, almost the entire stage covers that genre. So to Bernie's credit, he's somewhat moved the debate, and some of those issues where he's moved the debate are not terribly controversial. Most working class Americans and most Americans as a whole think some of those issues as they stand by themselves have more than a point.
Can I just say, can I just get in for a minute?
Real quickly, Rich, real quick.
Yeah, what's happened the last time around, Bernie Sanders was the only game in town. So anyone who was to the left of Hillary Clinton or didn't like Hillary Clinton, he was the only candidate with that ideology. It's the same thing that happened with Eugene McCarthy in 68. Eugene McCarthy ran – he was the only anti-Vietnam War candidate against Hubert Humphrey. After Robert Kennedy died, he ran again in 72. He only got 3.46% of the vote. His view had now become mainstream in the party. And George McGovern, the senator from South Dakota, who was a 200-to-1 long shot, became the de facto anti-Vietnam War candidate. It's the same thing that's happening with Bernie Sanders, it happened with Eugene McCarthy.
Okay. Now, before we get to the should they stay or should they go part of this, I know Dan Lipner's been wanting to talk about this candidate for a few minutes. Let's talk about the Queen of Love. Let's talk about Marianne Williamson. Dan Lipner, she's gonna take over the country and take over the White House with love and kindness and bee pollen and honey and all kinds of stuff. Dan, you're singing into a microphone and you're muted. So that just shows you the technological advantage of doing this by remote. Dan,
world needs now is love, sweet love. Love's all you need.
Okay. Well, with that being the case, she did not help herself apparently during the debate.
Oh no, she helped herself. Her book sales will go up.
That will lead us into our final part of the show where we're going to
go ahead. Absolutely not be on the debate stage. Absolutely. On the handful of things that I posted.
How did she let me ask this question as a Democrat? How did she get on the stage and you don't include the governor of Montana who won in a red state?
Well, I mean, that's the nature, and this is what Alan was talking about as far as how people were selected for the debate. And it was a very democratic process, unfortunately, in this case, whether or not the sincerity of the candidate was actually at play. The democracy of the process was the where you were in the polls and how many donors you had. And somebody who is endorsed by Oprah, not as a presidential candidate, but as a self-help guru,
and best-selling author,
right? And I believe Oprah is part of that best-selling author formula. That's not to say that was the worst idea in the world, but now that we've gotten past that, we should get past that. The idea that Marianne Williamson, that love is all you need, is insane. The most valuable thing that she brought to the debate was saying that, by the way, all these ideas and plans that people have, which is still surreal to me, is the only thing that we're going to need to beat Trump. We're going to need a slogan because Trump won on Make America Great Again, which there is more than a little bit of credit that is deserved on that point. that we have to figure out how to package whatever candidate, because in the reality television version of American politics that is Donald Trump, yeah, this is a real thing. It's a scary thing, but it's a real thing. Marianne Williamson is also devoid of substance as far as anything meaningful, and also has no slogan to beat Donald Trump. She should not be on the stage next go-round, but she deserves credit for making that point.
I want to know her view on the line on a veto.
Yeah, exactly. So that works. That good one, Rich. Okay, we're going to go down the list, and I want one-word answer. I'm going to be like Chuck Todd. I want one-word answers. Do they stay or do they go between now and the CNN Detroit debates? I think we're all in agreement. Senator Harris stays. Is that correct? Yes.
Yes.
Could we learn how to pronounce her first name, please?
It's Kamala.
Kamala. Not Kamala. Kamala.
Kamala.
Kamala.
Potato, potato. Yeah, no, okay, Kamala Harris. No, he's right.
Kamala as in the
Kamala Harris. Okay, I'm just going to go with Senator Harris.
Yes, as in the punctuation, yes.
Okay, there we go. Okay, Julian Castro, yes or stay or go?
Stay.
Stays.
I used to be stays, no, but now I'm stay.
He should maybe run against Cornyn anyway, no, but he stays for now.
Beto might do that.
Yeah, that's
no,
true.
Beto, anyway. Beto will never make it. He's toast.
All right, Mayor Pete Buttigieg, stay?
Yep.
Obviously, we're
stay.
All in agreement in that. He's
absolutely
doing well. He's doing well.
We didn't give him any cover.
No,
he did pretty well.
He did very well.
He raised $24 million.
Bold statement about saying, as far as the racial issues with the police department in his city, saying, I just couldn't get that done. That was a very politically brave statement.
A very politically brave statement. So let's look at Mr. Yang. Does he stay or go?
Go.
Go.
Dear God, go away and go away now.
And we've already covered Ms. Williamson. Senator Warren, we know, stays. Tulsi Gabbard, interesting. It seems to me like she's just running for Secretary of Defense more so than president. Did she stay or go?
I would say stay, but I don't know if she would be Secretary of Defense. I think her views are more divergent than most of the Democratic candidates other than Bernie Sanders.
She's too young for DOD, but we're learning about her. Does she stay or go? Okay.
Does she stay or go?
She goes.
Dan?
She's a lot more impressive than I had previously taken for her. Secretary of Defense, a young SecDef, I wouldn't be against. However, she's got other challenging issues that she's talked about.
Cory Booker, Bernie Sanders obviously are going to stay.
Booker, you're overstating that. I think Booker's got one more debate to show he's got chops to make some points. But it's not clear he's there before one more debate.
Real quickly, to go down the line. Amy Klobuchar, stay or go?
Stay.
Barely. Dan Lipner?
Klobuchar has she
one
wins
word, stay or go? Quickly.
Both one-liners at the moment. She stays for at least one more debate.
Yep. Okay. I would say stay, and also she's spending a lot of time in rural Iowa. Would watch that to see how she's, you know, that's a place a lot of other candidates aren't going very, very rural.
Got it. We got a minute left, guys. I got to go through the other 10 of them. Gillibrand, stay or go?
Go.
Go.
Unfortunately for her, in spite of all of her best efforts, go.
Jay Inslee, stay or go?
Go.
Probably stay just because the climate change issue has become so galvanizing in the party.
Right. De Blasio, stay or go?
Hey, I don't get stuck on Inslee.
You said go. I got a minute left. You got to stay quick. Got to be quick.
Does
Jay Inslee stay or go?
He goes, but mostly because he's bad on TV.
Okay, very good. Bill De Blasio, mayor of New York, stay or go?
Go.
Rich?
It's hard to envision where a mayor of the biggest city in the country goes. I just can't envision that scenario.
Dan Lipner?
So I would have to say stay.
Dan Lipner?
He's made no impact on the debates other than making noise as a loud New Yorker. He goes.
Maryland Congressman Delaney, stay or go?
Go.
Go.
He said some interesting things on healthcare. I'm still waiting to see how it plays out.
Beto O'Rourke, stay or go?
Stay.
I'd say one more. I'd say one more to make him redeem himself.
Yeah. Dan Lipner?
We need to see his money numbers.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah, Dan Lipner, you agree? If his money numbers aren't there, he goes. If he somehow manages to keep his growiness raising money, then he stays.
Okay, we're getting played off here in about 2 seconds. Last ones. Eric Swalwell, stay or go?
Go.
Go.
Run for re-election instead.
Dan?
Never should have been there. Go.
And Congressman Ryan from Ohio, stay or go?
Go. You've left out Michael Bennett, too.
Oh, yeah, I did leave out Michael Bennett. Does Bennett stay or go?
You also left off Hickenlooper.
I think he's gone, too.
No, I think Hickenlooper should stay.
Really?
Congressman Ryan should also stay. He's actually brought some interesting points to the table. And, by the way, not a minority position either, saying that we need to – and this is the is the Mayor Buttigieg, the idea that we need to focus on middle America and working Americans. He should absolutely stay. Hickenlooper similarly should stay.
Yeah, and that's music.
What is reason for staying?
Everybody, that is the music. That means we're done here. It has been a great show. Thank you very much. Dan Lipner, Alan Moore, Rich Rubino, and of course, trying to keep us on schedule, Rob, the engineer behind the glass. Special thanks, obviously, to Eric Thomas, our producer. And you can always listen to us on your favorite podcasting services. You can download us on iTunes, what's left of it, Google Podcasts. You can also download us on Spreaker and iHeartRadio. What's that?
Who does iTunes?
Stop, whatever. Anyway, America, have a great week. We'll talk to you in our next episode. Thanks a lot for joining us. Bye-bye.